Thank you. As you're getting settled, I'll just state, so this is, and perhaps counsel for appellant can, or counsel for respondents can correct me, this is a B-Swart and respondents versus Sean Company. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their arguments in chief, respondents will have 15 minutes for their argument, and appellants will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So once you're ready, just approach the microphone. The podium goes up and down. Just the microphone to your level, and just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jason Rather, here on behalf of the appellant. I want to clarify, first of all, the bases for appeal. We eliminated some that we had placed in our notice of appeal, and as our brief states, there's really four bases of appeal that we bring before this court. One is the district court's erroneous application of the statute of limitations. One is the district court's erroneous factual findings that the Beezerts and Thunderblades had fully paid for services, attorney fees, and then the issue of damages. First, on the issue
so
of...
So which one are you giving up?
There is about three or four others.
Okay, so just that's all you want us to focus on?
Correct, Your
Honor.
Thank you. I want to be clear about that.
Thank you, Mr. Rather.
So first of all, I would like to talk about the statute of limitations. There has been some discussion in the brief about the appropriate standard of review. It is our belief and our stance that the appropriate standard of review is a de novo standard of review. There's really no dispute as to the underlying facts here that determine the application of the statute of limitations. Nobody disputes that there was an accountant-client relationship between Beezerts and the Thunderblades on one hand and Sean Company on the other hand. There's no dispute that Sean Company did not demand payment and invoice the clients until November of 2016. There's no dispute that they failed to pay that invoice within 10 days or immediately, depending on which engagement letter you refer to. And so based on that...
There's also no dispute that they had been making periodic payments for years.
And thank you, Your Honor. That goes to my second basis for our appeal. If you want, I can address that now.
No, but I mean, doesn't that inform to some extent the statute of limitations argument as well? There had been payments up until a certain time and then nothing for a period of time.
Well, and so, Your Honor, when those payments were made, and as we've laid out in a brief, as evidence adduced at the trial court showed, when those payments were made, Romanek Shaw told Mr. Beezwert, well, I understand that you haven't paid everything, but we'll accept the full payment when you can, or words to that effect. So when those payments were made, there was an understanding between the parties that eventually we're going to want to get paid all of the money that we are owed. But for now, I am letting you go. Well, this is a great example of a no good deed goes unpunished, because eventually...
But didn't the trial court reject that in its findings?
The trial court did reject the full payment in its... findings, and that is the second basis for appeal.
Rejected this unwritten agreement that more money was due. I mean, that was all presented to the trial court, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And so for the second basis of our appeal, we found that we believe that the court clearly erred in making a factual finding that Shaw and Company had been fully paid for its services. And that mainly what we rely on in our brief for that point is not the testimony of my clients, which testified consistently that they were expecting to get more money, but actually the testimony of the respondents themselves. Because if you look at the respondents' testimony, Mr. Beezerts admitted that he expected at some point to potentially have to pay more. In fact, Mr. Beezerts' attorney sent a letter to my clients asking them, what is the full amount that is owed? Why would you ask somebody to bill you for what the full amount is owed if you thought you had paid everything? Mr. Beezer testified before the trial court. I thought there.
Couldn't that be for settlement purposes? I mean, it's like I want to know what you say I owe, so that I can determine how much I'm not going to give you.
Well, if that was the case, that wasn't stated in the letter. It certainly wasn't stated in the frame of 408 discussions, and it was actually brought up by respondents' counsel in their brief. So we would say it wasn't actually a settlement communication, or would likely be before this court. They wanted to find they wanted to get an invoice, and they did get an invoice, and then decided not to pay.
Well, I assume the letter didn't say, "Please tell me how much you say we owe, so I can quickly write you a check for the full amount."
You know,
I assume it didn't say that.
The exact wording of the letter I do not have at the tip of my tongue.
I'm gonna go with it didn't say that.
Okay. It didn't, but regardless.
Any of the invoices that were provided finally in late 2016 provide your client's standard hourly rates, the actual time spent, and the and a breakdown of the out-of-pocket expenses your client incurred?
No, they did not, Your Honor. What they stated was the flat fee amount that had been agreed to between the parties.
Although the written agreements that you submit don't say anything about a flat fee, they in fact talk about fees based on standard hourly rates and actual time spent. How do you prevail on a breach of contract claim when you didn't comply with the contract by submitting invoices and that laid out the agreed to payment terms?
Well, the contract didn't require that they submit invoices until they wanted to be paid. There's the letters themselves don't require Sean.
And I understand that, but the invoices that ultimately were provided in November of 2016 don't identify your client's standard hourly rate, actual time spent, and out-of-pocket expenses. So they weren't. It seems to me your client didn't live up to its part of the contract fully by failing to provide an invoice that broke those things out.
Well, and I understand the court's question, but the engagement letters themselves didn't set up any requirements as to the actual details that would be in the invoice. And as our clients testified to at trial, there was this arrangement that they would be paid a flat fee instead of an hourly fee, which was stated, as Your Honor notes, in the engagement letters.
But that was a disputed fact at trial that the judge rejected, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. That the judge rejected a flat fee amount, but then the judge also said that they were paid fully, which does not comport with the evidence that was adduced at trial. We believe that there is some amount of money that is owed Shaw and Company here, and that's why this case needs to be remanded for a full factual finding on the amounts that are owed.
But then I get back to how did your client prove its damages? Was there testimony about the number of hours spent, the reasonable hourly rate, and the specific out-of-pocket expenses for the periods in which you're claiming the respondents didn't make the required contractual payment?
Your Honor, there was testimony about the rates that would normally be charged. There was testimony as to the basis for out-of-pocket costs. I believe the out-of-pocket costs were listed on the invoices, but they were not broken down.
They weren't broken down into what they were.
Yeah.
And the idea is it's the same amount every year?
The out-of-pocket cost would not likely be the same amount every year, adjusted for filing fees and whatnot. But there was testimony on those issues, and there was testimony as to what the basis was for the finding of the amounts actually in the invoice. And the testimony at trial indicated that there was actually less billed to the client on a flat fee basis as to what there was on an hourly basis. Unfortunately, the district court accepted this proposition that Shaw and Company had been paid in full, in what we believe is a completely contrary finding to the great weight of the evidence adduced at trial.
The thing I'm troubled with on appeal is it seems like you're asking us to second-guess the credibility decision determinations and other findings of fact that the district court made, and that is the district court's unique job to make.
Well, Your Honor, appellant does respect the fact that the trial court does have a broad level of discretion on factual findings, but it is not an unlimited level of discretion, and that at a certain point that the appellate court is empowered to look at the evidence that was presented in trial and decide if the finding.
So you're saying there's no evidence that supports the decision of the district court?
I wouldn't go as far as to say there was no evidence. There was equivocal testimony on that, but the same testimony, as cited in our brief, showed that the Beeswerts and Thunderblades did owe more money. We feel that the great weight of that testimony showed that they had not been paid in full.
I know the portion of the testimony you're referring to, but I didn't see anything about a number. They didn't come up with, oh, and by the way, we think it's $4,000.
And in this case, respondents did not say, we actually owe this amount, correct? Our clients did give a number, and that was the number as stated in the invoices. The district court would have had discretion to say, well, we think that the amount stated in your invoice is contrary to the terms of your contract, but you're still owed something based on the fact of, you know, at some point, plaintiffs owed admissions at various points of this matter, including the letter asking for an invoice,
But this is a breach of contract claim. This isn't a quantum merit equitable claim or anything like that, right?
Well, there was an unjust enrichment claim brought before the court, but we are appealing specifically
right.
the finding that there all the amounts were paid to Shaw and Company. Because if you have that factual finding, you don't have unjust enrichment. Obviously, you wouldn't have quantum merit. But that factual finding itself is what we're focused on here as part of our appeal.
What case law, getting back, I guess, to the statute of limitations sort of issue, what case law supports your argument that providing the respondents with invoices in November of 2016 was a reasonable time frame in which to do that with respect to work done before 2011?
Thank you, Your Honor. That would be the Bannetts case that's cited in our brief. And in that case, you had demand for payment made more than 10 years after some of the wages had accrued. Some of the wages at issue in that case were accrued in 1925. The plaintiff made their demand in 1942. So that's actually, I'm sorry, my math is off, almost 17 years later than when some of the amounts had been owed. And in that case, the court said that given the relationship of trust between an employer and employee, it was a reasonable amount of time for the employee to make a demand at some later point.
Right. Do we have the comparable relationship, though, between the parties? I mean, this was someone who was hired to do tax kind of work on an annual basis, correct?
Is that
akin to an employment relationship?
Well, in fact, I would say that here the relationship of trust is even higher. I would say that the fiduciary components of an attorney-client relationship are actually much greater than that which you'd find between an employer and an employee.
Is there a case law that would support that argument?
There's not a specific case about governing the accountant-client relationship in this context.
And I mean, I'm sorry, are you suggesting that the fiduciary relationship goes client to lawyer?
As far as the, well, what I would say in the Bannetts case is that the case does not say it's because the employee trusted the employer, it characterized the entire relationship as one of trust. That goes both ways. And I think that there is some level of trust that does go both ways in an accountant-client relationship, that relationship of trust does merit an extension for the time to actually demand an invoice.
So Comcast can trust me every month to pay the bills no matter what, even if I'm not getting the service, and they can sue me for breach of fiduciary duty? Boy,
well,
I hope that's not the law.
Well,
because I dispute those bills every waking moment of my life.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Well, you fortunately, well, I guess for Comcast, they don't have a fiduciary relationship to you. So that
Well, thank God for that. I'll tell them that the next time they try to stiff me.
But, I mean, I understand Your Honor's point, but I think that the Bannetts Court does not, again, restrict it, just saying this is a one-way situation. It's based on actually the relationship of the parties. And here there is a
Which is a, you know, and following up on Judge Bjorkman's excellent question, which is a hands-off, you know, client-lawyer, you know, service-provider, service-acceptor relationship, and, you know, where people complain about the bills every time, and lawyers complain about they haven't been. I mean, I think we would be very reluctant to go down that road to provide support for your argument as to why why your client would win in this case.
Well, and I'm assuming you mean that in the road of allowing a firm or another professional service provider to wait to actually demand payment.
Yes.
Well,
particularly when you've got a written contract, where, as Judge Bjorkman has pointed out, it seems like from Mr. Moore's client's perspective, you know, we weren't getting these regular invoices and hourly rates and breakdown of costs on a timely basis. Yeah.
Well, and as we raised in our brief, there were also discussions about this. And Mr. Shaw told Mr. Beezer,
Were there any discussions along the lines of, pay me when you can, and in the interim, that means I'm not going to be sending you the invoices, the cost breakdown, the blah, 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 that I'm supposed to every month in the engagement letter?
There are actually words to that effect that are cited in our brief, where he says, I'm not going to, when Mr. Beezer asked for an invoice, Mr. Shaw said, don't worry about it for now. Pay me when you can what you can pay me.
Right.
Not exactly the words that Your Honor used.
Right, because I would be looking then, to support that argument, I would be looking for your client to say, and therefore, you know, fair is fair, I'm not going to be like, you know, itemizing everything on a monthly basis, right? For, and then they say, yeah, that's fair. I mean, I don't see that, right?
There was not that level of discussion in the record.
Fair enough.
I do want to touch briefly on our damages argument. Unless
I'm going to ask a question about that then, because I was going to ask you about damages too, because would you agree that in order to prevail on your breach of contract claim, you'd have to prove damages?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And
so my question then is, in looking at the invoices that were submitted that were based on a flat fee, the court rejected that. So in my review of the record anyway, I didn't see where the trial court was presented with evidence such as, for tax year 2007, for instance, our firm provided these services, A, B, C, D. It took these hours, you know, whatever they are. Our hourly rate is this, and our cost for doing A, B, C, and D was this. Was the court given that specific evidence at trial to make a determination as on an hourly basis per year as opposed to a flat fee?
Not a per specific tax year, but yes, there was testimony about what was being done to justify those fees. There's very specific testimony about what efforts and services Shaw & Company provided within the terms of the engagement letter. I see my time is flashing. So
thank you. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal to further discuss the damages issue, Mr. Rather. You're welcome. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondents, please.
Perfect.
May it please the court. I would first like to discuss the standard.
What's your name first, sir?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. My name is Patrick Moore. I'm here representing the respondents, the Bues Arts and Thunderblades. The first thing I'd like to discuss before the court is the standard of review. I firmly believe that the standard, the correct standard, is the abuse of discretion standard. I do not believe that it is a de novo standard. I believe that the underlying facts of this case are the key to this case. It is exactly what was the understanding of the parties that helps us determine whether or not the statute of limitations told, and helps us determine how to interpret the contracts, the 17 contracts that were between the parties for each and every year that the taxes and the tax services were performed.
Doesn't this court usually look at district court findings of fact to see if they are clearly erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would like to, during my discussion, I was going to talk about Rule 52 and the findings of fact, and that clearly erroneous is the standard for that. So thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I would like to point out that the appellant drafted the annual engagement letters. There were 17 of them, one for each and every tax year. It was testified at trial court that none of these engagement letters contained a price. It was also testified by the respondents that they were never verbally told a price, that there was no price list given to them separate from the engagement letter, that there were no prices posted in the accounting office that they went to. These people had no idea what they were going to be charged for these services. They were never told this.
But wasn't there also testimony that Mr. Shaw, when accepting payments, periodic payments from your clients, said, yeah, that doesn't pay for all of it, but I'll take that and you can continue. I mean, Mr. Shaw knew about their financial circumstances because, you know, he did their taxes. And he made some statement along the lines that this may not be all of it, but you can pay me more when you're able. I mean, that was the evidence, was it not?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, but so then I want to ask the question, then how do we support, or how do we find that the district court's finding that Mr. Shaw accepted the periodic payments in full satisfaction of the money owed. How is that not a clearly erroneous finding of fact?
Well, Your Honor, the way I would put it is this. Mr. Shaw did accept the payments, and Mr. Shaw did say, yeah, you still owe me money. But when asked, he would never divulge how much money. And that really is the heart of this. When we look at the appellant's arguments, the appellant wants to argue that money was outstanding, and when demand was made, the money was not paid. But the problem here is that nobody wants to talk about the fact that my clients were begging to find out how much money was owed. What were they being charged? And they were never, ever told this, despite multiple requests.
And I understand that piece, but it's fair to say that your clients knew when they made these periodic payments that they still owed more money.
Well, yes, they were told that they owed more money. They had no idea how much.
I get that point, but to find that these payments were made in full satisfaction, it seems to me there wasn't testimony from any parties that they understood the payments fully satisfied the outstanding obligation.
Correct. And I would say this. The good faith payments were made to head off exactly why we're here today. The good faith payments were made because my client did not want to wind up in a situation where they owed an exorbitant amount to the appellant without realizing how big of a bill they were racking up. So they were making these good faith payments on a regular basis and saying, gee, does this satisfy our debt? What do we owe you? And the appellant responded by saying, don't worry about it. The truth is this. The appellant is trying to couch this, that this was done as a courtesy to my client. The truth is, and it was testified to in the trial court, that the appellant was engaging in a poor business practice. His son on the witness stand said, this is not my practice. I send out regular bills. I'm more of a corporate type of CPA, but my dad is more like a country doctor, and he doesn't send out regular bills. And Judge Castro said, what do you think of this practice? And he said, it's not my practice, indicating that it's a lazy business practice. And what I would say to you is that this would be
or it could be characterized as a generous business practice.
Correct, depending on the facts, which is why I believe abuse of discretion is the standard here, because it's those facts, that understanding of the party that we really have to look at to decide if these statutes told and if there was accord and satisfaction with the payments. So what I would say to you is that this would be a much different case if every year my client had been given a detailed invoice saying, here's what you owe me, sir, but you can pay me later when I demand it. If my client had been given an invoice, a sum certain, knowing this is what I owe this gentleman for doing these services, and then 12 years later received a bill for $45,000, only having paid $21,000 of it, my client, I believe the statute would start from the date of that demand. Now I want my $45,000. But instead, my client didn't know if they owed a dollar or $1 million. They were begging to know this. They eventually quit using the appellant because they couldn't get the taxes done in a timely fashion, and they were fearful of what they may or may not owe the appellant. So they came to my office, and I was the one that drafted the demand letter, so I can tell you what it says. My demand letter did say, we want the tax material, and we will pay a reasonable invoice. Because at that time, we didn't know. Do we owe more? Do we not owe more? Is it a lot more? Is it a little more? What do these guys think? And to Your Honor's earlier comments, we weren't sure if what they were thinking was reasonable or unreasonable. Our concern was is that they might be unreasonable. There was no fiduciary relationship here. This was a client that runs a roller skating rink going into a CPA firm to get taxes done annually. There was no fiduciary relationship. It was a customer and a service provider.
I'd like to ask you a question about the tax, the IRS tax notice or the penalty notice. I've reviewed it, I've seen it, and you know, it does indicate on its term, on its face, that there is an opportunity perhaps to contact the IRS to see about adjusting the penalty or challenging the penalty or whatever. Given that fact that there's some extent to which that obligation may be satisfied other than paying the penalty outright, is there any evidence in this record that your clients did in fact pay the $2,730 listed on the IRS notice?
My client did pay it, but there was no evidence in the record of it.
Okay. So what are we supposed to do about that?
Well, Your Honor, I believe...
There's no evidence in the record. How can we say it's owing?
Well, Your Honor, I believe...
Even though it may well be.
Yeah. Penalties from the IRS and notices such as that, we did put that in evidence. The amount was billed to the client. Unless you're only getting out of penalties if you have a reason to abate it. The reason to abate it being my CPA was late in getting everything done may or may not have worked. It depends on the agent that gets the abatement notice and what's going to happen.
Why wasn't evidence of actual payment presented to the trial court?
Your Honor, we just submitted the penalty notices, and that's as far as we got. I did not think to ask the client for anything more. So, Your Honors, I would like to talk about Park Nicollet versus Hammond. I would like to talk to you about one case. Under Minnesota law, according to this case, a cause of action accrues when all the elements exist to the extent that a claim could withstand a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. I'd like to submit to this court that the Shaws were unilateral, the appellants were unilateral in this whole situation. They unilaterally drafted the engagement agreements. They unilaterally chose not to put prices in there. They unilaterally chose not to timely invoice. And they unilaterally chose to wait until after a conciliation court action against them was posed before they sent the $45,000 invoice out. They had all the elements for a cause of action against my clients. If they'd wanted to invoice at any time starting in 2002, they could have, and if they had not received payment, they could have brought action against my clients. They sat on their rights. They failed the invoice like a good business would do, and they received good faith payments because my clients were concerned about being hit with an unreasonable bill. And as Your Honors pointed out earlier, at trial and before trial, we could not get them to give us itemized bills. They had no idea that they were being charged a flat rate of $3,000 a year. That never came up until they got the invoice after they sued to get their material back. I would submit to the court.
But Mr. Moore, I just want to make sure. So you're saying the record supports that during this 12-year period at various times, your client specifically said, we want to know what the dollar amount is owing. We want an invoice. You're saying the record supports that?
Yes. My client asked the Shaws, how much do I owe you? What do I owe you? And he was always told, don't worry about it. And that's why he got nervous and started making the periodic payments, because he did not want to be in debt to these people. They're saying again, as Your Honor pointed out, that this was out of the goodness of their heart. My client is saying, no, I wanted to pay. They just were failing to invoice. It was a lazy business practice. And again, this was admitted on the record at the trial court. And I believe that Judge Castro made his opinion based on that. Your Your Honor, I promised earlier that I would bring up Rule 52. Findings of fact, whether based on oral or documentary evidence, shall not be set aside unless clearly erroneous, and due regard shall be given opportunity of the trial court to judge the credibility of the witnesses. And again, that's what Judge Castro did. Let's talk about attorney fees, Your Honors. The appellant drafted and had my client sign an engagement letter each and every year. There were 17 of these. Only 2013 and 2014 mentioned the collection of attorney fees for unpaid balances.
Or we don't even have to get to that issue if we find no breach of contract, correct?
Correct. Thank you, Your Honor. So, Your Honor, in conclusion, I would like to say that I hope that you affirm the trial court on all issues. They did not abuse their discretion in finding the way that they did. Their findings of fact, conclusions of law, are not clearly erroneous. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Mr. Rather, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors. It may be a minor point, but I think it is worth raising that in the respondent's brief, they described the standard of review as a mixed question of fact and law. We believe that regardless of whatever standard the court uses, that the statute of limitations ruling by the district court was erroneous. As far as the full amount goes, there was a statement here that the clients knew they owed more money at the time that they paid that, and they were starting to get concerned. Now, there was no evidence, from my recollection, and there certainly isn't before this court, that the clients quit working with Shaw & Company because they were worried about what they were owed. The reason told to the trial court and before in the record before this court is the dispute over the taxes being done. I think the question
is, does that matter, really, for our purposes? Why?
Well, not necessarily, but it was raised during argument, and I just didn't, you know, I wanted to be clear that that's not in the record. What the issue here, though, is, you know, what? Why would the clients, why would the Beeswerks and Thunderblades continue to use Shaw & Company's services if there really was this grand mystery about what they actually owed? They were using Shaw & Company service from 2003 for more than 10 years, and what we heard from counsel is that they, every time they paid, they were more and more concerned that they didn't know what they would actually owe. I think that that goes to our question about whether the court's findings were clearly erroneous. I think that that type of a situation is unbelievable at best.
Well, couldn't they have been equally concerned about what it was claimed they owed? I mean, they were asking for a figure and they weren't given one. Wouldn't it be reasonable for a person, even if they felt they had paid, you know, fair consideration for what had been done, to want to know if, are you going to make a further claim against me? I mean, they were asking for that information, really, weren't they?
They were asking for what was owed. At least that's in the testimony before the court. There wasn't any indication that they were concerned that a claim was going to be made against them.
Well, no, they were asking, what do you say I owe you? They don't know if they would have agreed with that or not until they were given a figure. Isn't that a fair characterization?
Well, the testimony before the court, and to answer your Honor's question directly, I understand, yes, that's one way you could characterize the evidence. But the actual evidence before the court was this flat fee arrangement. And if there was confusion about what was owed, it was a calculation versus what they had paid versus what had accrued on the account. Not that there was somehow a grand mystery, again, as to what was actually going to be charged them.
But that was a fact issue about the flat fee, and the court rejected that. So now we're back to an hourly expense calculation, aren't we? Otherwise, you're asking us to judge credibility, and there was mixed testimony on that in terms of whether if there was any flat fee discussion. So, you know, we'd have to find that the court abused its discretion in rejecting that to even get to your argument, wouldn't we?
Correct, Your Honor. What we're asking is that this court find that the court abused its discretion in finding that, that Shaw & Company was fully paid. And if the court reverses that finding, that means that the trial court needs to make a more rigorous factual determination and review the evidence. It may require more testimony about what was actually done per tax year.
Other than your client's testimony, what evidence was in the record that this arrangement was based upon a flat fee per year?
That was just based on the testimony, Your Honor.
And the respondents disagreed with that?
They disagreed with that, and there is no written evidence besides for the letter in 2016 of any dispute about the fee arrangement either.
Well, so except every engagement letter contemplated an hourly rate and a listing of actual time spent. I mean, that was evidence, was it not?
That is correct, Your Honor. Yes, the engagement letter, and we concede that the engagement letter terms do not match exactly what was invoiced, and as the testimony was adduced at trial, that the actual invoice amounts were less than what would have been charged if it had been done on an hourly basis. I just want to talk briefly about the damages. I think that the court raised some excellent issues there. As counsel conceded, as he must, there is no evidence that they were actually paid any of these amounts. Counsel's testimony, obviously, here in argument is not evidence for this court to consider. We cited numerous bases within our brief as to how Thunderblades and Beezerts could have contested this amount, including a Sixth Circuit case where they found that the IRS abuses discretion imposing penalties based on the fault of the accountant, which is exactly what the respondents are alleging occurred here. So we ask that this court reverse the trial court on its determination related to the statute of limitations, find that the Shaw & Company were not paid their full amount, which would then entail the attorney fees, as Your Honor correctly noted. And then finally, we ask that the court find that there is no evidence supporting the claim for damages and reverse the trial court on that grounds. My time is up, so unless you had any more questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Rather. The matter is submitted.
Thank you.